All right. Here's a second space of today to discuss some general hardening tips and topics for Linux and Windows. So we will get started in about 5 minutes. I'm just going to wait and see if anybody is able to join this evening. So I'm going to probably just either not talk or ramble for the next 5 minutes while I also share this tweet. Okay, let's see. I shared that. I will go share it here. Let's see here. Okay, I just retweeted that out and I spelled Linux with a Y instead of a U. So that's great. But yeah. So we'll just talk about a few some general different topics, things to do with the operating system you were using. Actually, I'm not sure my headset is working, so 1 minute. Yeah, so I had my computer audio up. So yeah, again, anyway, so a few different things I would do around hardware, software, managing our operating system, monitoring techniques, that sort of thing. It include, yeah, just. Yeah, I think that's basically what I'm including today. If you want to, well, I'll hold off on that actually. I'm gonna wait some a few more minutes to see if anybody is able to join. One second, I'm just like double retweeting this out. Takes a little while to build traction on things like this, and it's really hard for me to figure out when people are available. Yep, just hang tight if you're listening to the recording. I'll be starting in just a couple of minutes here, so you could probably fast forward until you start hearing me continuously rambling on. Copy. Okay, we'll post that there. All right, I think I've done enough of that. Yeah, so what I'll be talking about is kind of what happened earlier on the first Twitter Spaces. Michael Leisenfeld, or Dr. Leisenfeld, and Lothesen, he's from Chirp Drops. They joined, and we had a kind of just brought up a couple handful of different topics and discussed them and got everybody's opinion. So I'd highly suggest going back and watching that. Specifically, at least, well, I'd watch it all because Lath and Michael both had great things to share out throughout the entire conversation for that out a little over an hour of time. But one thing I won't get too in detail on right now, not exact, I guess, to be honest, not super prepared for it, but would be hardware considerations. I do have a few things to mention on that, but if you want some really technical thought around that, go watch like the 15, 20 minutes of my Twitter space from around noon Eastern today. You can find that on my timeline, on epochsec.io's Twitter timeline, or you can find it on my website, epochsec.io. Just go to the information feed page, and you'll find that. I try to make each item I shared on there very easy to see. There's a search feature on there too, so you can search Linux or something like that, and you'll find it. Anyway, it's like, I think it's like the most recent thing I posted on there, except for the two pinned posts I have on my site about my survey and just overall project information. But anyway, to just go over the hardware thing as real quick, the fundamentally the hard everything starts at the hardware, right? Unless you're very familiar with hardware and the functionality of them, what a BIOS does, what are the different chipsets, what is open source firmware, what is closed source, what are the concerns around all of that. Again, you could get a little insight from that from mine and Michael's conversation earlier today, but until you understand those things, I'll just give a couple of basic things to consider around that. So real basic, when you start up a computer for the, every time you start up a computer for the first time, it has to do a post, a power on self test, right? What happens is the BIOS goes through that, and after all of that has passed, and then what it does is it posts the operating system. Until all of that is done, the operating system doesn't get posted, doesn't load, right? So, w one good easy thing to do. Again, this is a lot of this is really around advising the average user or even the advanced people that are, just aren't aware of these things. But the first thing would be to consider topics around or things around full disk encryption. So what full disk encryption is, in a nutshell, is encrypting the master boot record, and during your first power during a power powering on the system, it's going to go through post and all of that, and it's going to need to authenticate using that cryptographic key from the full disk encryption. If it has that, then it'll post, and then it'll load the operating system. If it cannot authenticate to that, it will not then post the operating system. So an easy example would be if you lost your laptop, somebody got a hold of it, and you had full disk encryption set up. Say they took that drive out and tried to put it into another system. Well, that drive with the operating system installed would not be able to you would not be able to then post the OS and load the OS because the it there wouldn't you would not be able to authenticate with the keys to get past the encrypted master boot record. So again, in an even simpler way to think of it is I think I had oh yeah so I had this thought earlier. So if you're familiar with TPM as well, that's I would say think of it like a keypad to disarm your security alarm that then lets you into your house, right? And once you get into your house, then you load the operating system. You know, you're visually seeing everything in your house. You could do things with it. You can interact with it, etc., right? But if you can't get past that keypad, then you can't even access the house, right? So that's what full disk encryption is. If you can't authenticate to that, then you can't even access your operating system. So if somebody took your hard drive, put it into another laptop, it wouldn't be able to authenticate, wouldn't be able, essentially wouldn't be able to work. There are some very advanced techniques you can do to try to bypass that, but it's not very easy. And yeah. So I'll leave it at that. Something else that Michael mentioned earlier around this discussion. So we had a discussion about this, and I also mentioned that I like to use my System 76 machine with Pop! OS installed. It's a derivative of Ubuntu with open source firmware. So open source meaning I can, you can validate things against it. You can then have more manipulation over your own firmware, making it more secure. But most things out there are not open source. The hardware, the firmware, etc. Most of it is closed source, and in a very short summary, you really don't know what is happening there, right? So you can never really be sure that it's secure. Again, I suggest going listening to that part of the Torch space. But one thing that I wanted to mention that he mentioned was something called Librem or Purism. So this is a company that makes all sorts of firmware. Authentication stuff, hardware, and it's all open source as well. So, if you want to look into that, I actually just started looking into it. I'm not extremely familiar with them, but if you want to look into that, it could. I'm going to as well, and it might be fun, something fun to dig into, and might even get something from them. But they apparently make all sorts of hardware, phones and stuff, firmware, etc. But again, that's Purism and Librem. Let me check spelling on that. Purism. Purism is spelled how it sounds. Librem is Librem. So, yeah, let me get back to the Twitter space here. Kind of going back and forth between documents and so forth. Yeah. Okay, so Let's start off with, well, we actually started off with a bunch of Linux stuff earlier, so let me switch that around today and I'll go through some the Windows stuff first. The Windows stuff, I guess, is technically maybe a little more, I guess it depends on your perspective. If you know Linux, then some of the things I'll mention are very straightforward. If you don't, then the things I'll mention in Windows are very straightforward. The differences being, in my opinion, the Linux tools and commands and so forth are easier to use once you know them. Windows, though, is not as easy to manipulate things, so there are less things you'll generally do as the average user. So that's kind of what allows that to be a little more straightforward. Again, I mentioned disk encryption. If you have a Windows machine, you have BitLocker on there by default. I think that would be fine to use. There are other products out there that you can buy. But again, I work for a very large security company, and we even have tools out there that helps manage BitLocker, because BitLocker is so popularly used. So I would suggest making sure you have that set up. Now, when you start your system, it's going to want you to authenticate to get to those cryptographic keys with a password or a key. So you'll set that up and you'll put that in and authenticate and buy and get past that. Then you'll get to Windows and need to then put in a password. Now you can set up SSO, called single sign-on, or yeah, single sign-on, which essentially, if you logged into or if you authenticated a BitLocker, it would bypass the Windows login and log you straight in. I suggest not doing that, for the obvious reason of having multiple layers of security, right? And the reason you really want drive encryption installed is because there, well, for one, there are a lot of tools that people can use to get information off your hard drive, FTK Imager. There's all sorts of things out there. But if they got past BitLocker, then they can brute force tools to try to gain your password for your Windows user account. And if you have SSO enabled, well, yeah, never mind on that point. Because SSO, yeah, never mind. I thought was going down the wrong path there. So I would do that. Another thing I would do is every time you get a new system, I would do two things. I would completely wipe the drives, because what Windows will do, just like a lot of other operating systems, there will be multiple partitions on there. There'll be partitions on there that you can't really do anything to. I think there is a restore partition and some other stuff, right? So completely wipe the drive, kind of do everything you can to wipe everything on that, and then reinstall a fresh copy of Windows. What this will do is also get rid of all of the bloatware that they put on there. I mean, everybody's got a new computer, and when you start it up, there's just a ton of things installed in there that you'll never use. There's a lot of problems with that. One, it's all that stuff running is consuming memory, consuming resources on your system that could be used for things that you need them to be used for. So it could bog down your system. Also, every single thing that you have on your system is essentially another possible a po po possibly another attack vector. If you have programs A, B, C, D, and E installed on there that you never use that came on there as bloatware, A, B, C, D, and E all have equal opportunities to become vulnerable and be compromised and used in a bad actor, malicious situation, right? I think Lathesin earlier, let me get back to it. I'll mention a tool you can use also to get rid of that bloatware. Yeah, Lethesan shared this link. You can find it on GitHub. It's called Sycnex, Sycnex. It's a Windows 10 debloater. It's a script that will remove all of that nonsense for you. So I would suggest checking that out and giving it a try. What else? Also, basic things like keeping everything updated. Now, Michael brought up another good point earlier, and it's very true that things, even updates, can have their issues and problems. They could introduce new vulnerability. They could, there could be vulnerabilities in those that the developers aren't aware of, and that gives the opportunity for bad actors to have zero-day attacks, which a zero-day attack is basically a malicious. Taking a malicious attack, taking advantage of a vulnerability that was just newly introduced, and also most likely not really known to anybody. So typically what happens in our field, a zero day is identified somebody by somebody, and then everybody starts scrambling to create resolutions for that. But anyway, just again, just for the daily average user, if you're not familiar with how to dig into those things and understand them, looking at release notes for updates and so forth, especially for Windows, it's very difficult to dig into any of that. Linux is a lot easier to control those things. But if you're not familiar and you don't have any knowledge on it, I would suggest two things in parallel. One, start trying to learn more about that. Secondly, just for the time being, just it's okay to practice normal updates, right? Let's see, different points to make here, but kind of along the lines of, just following the general idea of basics. I would, one thing you can do with your user account, right? Because when you create your user account, you have elevated privileges, and you could do, you have an admin account, and you could do pretty much anything. Not anything, but as anything an administrator account can do. What you can do in lieu of that is, you create that, you have your account, but then you create a secondary account, you add a new user, and you give it a lot less permissions. Things like, their general permissions on a system are reading something, opening a file, writing to the file or writing to something, a folder or whatever, executing something, those sort of things, right? So for a regular user, you may just not have it to where you can write or execute something, but you can read things. Or you may block down, you may lock it from using certain applications, that sort of thing. So that's something I would suggest working on building or creating and seeing if that works for you to use an idea like that. I'll get back to sys internals after the fact. One second while I take a drink. Okay. Yeah, so here the now the next point I'll make is something very obvious. You don't be afraid to use security products, right? Antivirus, or firewalls, exploit prevention things, IPS, IDS, so intrusion detection and intrusion prevention. Let's see. So, I mean, again, if you're just the average user and you don't want to dig in or you don't understand the different security products and vendors out there and what's best to use, at least start off with the already pre-installed or pre-set up, Windows security tools. Windows Defender being the antivirus tool, Exploit Guard being exploit prevention. Looking at that's that would cover things such as intrusion things, like I don't want to give bad examples, so I probably won't do that. But anyway, exploit guard is something else you can use. Yeah. So all of that stuff is looking at known threat. Okay, so exploit guard, an easy way to think of that is that is protecting you against people taking advantage of vulnerabilities in software, right? Or tools and things like that. So if there's a hole in the code and they know how to exploit that, as the product has mentioned, it's there to protect against exploiting things. Defender, back to that for a moment to just give the difference. Antivirus is looking for known malware, right? A defined piece of malware that everybody knows about, the name of it, information about it. It'll have that in a list and it'll block it if it shows up. So those are known threats. There's also features in there to look at things called, heuristics. So heuristics, what that is, maybe not known threats, so unknown threats, right? So things that are acting bad. So based on all the things we know about how bad things act, apply that to that unknown thing and start saying, it's doing more and more things that are indicative of malicious behavior. Firewalls, obviously. Firewalls are to block, that's, network traffic or host traffic, but network in nature, right? So if ports and protocols and IPs and all of that stuff, right? That's probably a simple way to explain that. But Windows should have all that there by default. Go ahead and leverage that. But I would also start looking at other options out there, tools you can monitor for use to monitor on your own. So sysinternals. So Microsoft has something out there. It was created by a guy named Mark Rusinovich in 96. It's still a widely used tool set. But again, it's sysinternals. It does all sorts of things, process scanning. You can monitor services, log on sessions, port monitoring. There are tools in there, PS tools in there, so you can obtain system information. You can use tools for PS ping or pinging, using ICMP, pinging things, a killing process, executing things. It's a very good tool if you are beyond the point to where you think you can supplement and or do a better job than the solutions you're already using on your system. I would also just advise start using it just to try it out, right? And even if you don't make sysinternals a daily habit on your Windows usage, you may pull things out of there, that may be key things that will help you in the future. Maybe one day you'll notice something when you're browsing the web and you'll be like, oh, maybe I remember seeing this thing in sysinternals or this other tool when I was trying to learn that, which I didn't learn it. But now you can apply it to that situation, right? So yeah, I would a few other things I'd suggest is not enable not using if you're not remoting into systems, which Lath mentioned earlier, and it's true that RDP in itself obviously is not malicious, right? It's used all the time, every second of every day by tens of thousands, millions of people, right? It's a very common thing to be used. But if you're that user at home with your laptop and you're just doing some crypto things and checking email and websites, and you don't need RDP or remote desktop protocol enabled. Make sure you don't have that enabled. Also public Wi-Fi. Public Wi-Fi can be dangerous. It's not necessarily dangerous, right? But it can be. You're on an open network where there are possibly tons of other people on that exact same network. It's very easy to discover your system and then attempt to access it and so forth, right? So when you're on public Wi-Fi, I would be extremely cautious and careful about anything that you're doing on your system. I wouldn't do anything that is sensitive on a public Wi-Fi if you're not sure that you're being safe and secure on that public Wi-Fi. One suggestion would be to use VPN services. Or using things such as Sysinternal and so forth. A VPN service I would probably mention is NordVPN. Lath and Michael mentions their suggestions earlier. I don't remember what they are, but again, you can go back and listen to that space and get that information. I'll be putting all this into a document sometime later in the week or next week. Also, just as a preventative measure, backing up your data, creating save points. You don't ever know when something could go wrong. Maybe just something as simple as your system becomes corrupt and you can't power it on anymore. Or your system is compromised, or you get malware and you're not sure what to do at that point, and you just kind of want to start fresh on a clean slate. You always want to make sure your stuff is backed up and secure, so that you can access that data outside of that system, especially if something ever happens to it. Okay, so application management. So installing things on your system. All too many times, I have seen people have all these applications installed on their computer. I asked them about it, and they said, "Well, these 5 things or these 10 things, I haven't used them in a year or 2 years, or I don't even know what they are." I would make it a common practice to always try to keep those things cleaned up, uninstall and remove things you don't use. Again, because those are all possible avenues for vulnerabilities to be introduced to them, and then in turn being used by bad actors in some malicious nature. Also, third-party tools or applications, right? There are a ton of wonderful third-party applications and tools out there that will be enjoyable to use, will make your life easier, and so forth, right? But I would just be careful on them. Anytime you're getting ready to start installing or using a third-party application, I would just do as much research as possible on that. In some of my other spaces, I've mentioned different ways to research them using VirusTotal, looking at the hash value of ensuring it's the exact file that you expect it to be, sorts of things like that. Or even just asking other people if they know anything about it, right? Or if they've used it, or things like that. Just try to do your due diligence on it before you use something that you're not familiar with. Don't sign in on web browsers, right? It's very common for people to sign in on their Google account on Chrome and Brave, and then do that on all of their systems. And then even furthermore, using those sync features for that browser sign in to sync it across all of your Chrome browsers on all of your systems. Obviously the bad thing there is, I think, it's just having you're signed in to applications on multiple systems with the exact same account. I would caution you to not do that. That's just a general safe security thing. It might be annoying to sign in every time, but that's that should be less of a concern, getting compromised or getting your information stolen should be more of a concern, right? Yeah, so try not to sign in a web browser or sync the web browser information or your account on multiple devices. Okay, so when you're setting up your system or you're setting up your account on your Windows device, do not use your main Microsoft account. What that'll do, that is an online account. And you do not want your online account being there. Instead, go into the user option, your user profile options, and ensure that you're signing in with a, or you, matter of fact, when you're just creating an account, make sure that you're choosing to set up a local account instead. That local account is local to the system and is not online and not publicly visible. I believe on Windows, I always, I never even enabled it, so I think it's still there. But if you do come across an option to enable automatic login, do not do that. Also, do not ever have an account with an empty password. That is a prime target for bad actors. Also, turning off location tracking. There's a feature. I don't know if I don't want to call it a feature, but there's a feature in Windows to enable location tracking. There's also an option in there for letting applications use advertising IDs. What this does is it provides you ads based on your application activity. So there are two features right there to track where you are and track what you do. I can't put it any more simple than that to get across the point to not enable those things and to disable them as soon as possible. When I brought this up earlier, I do recall Lathiesen and maybe Michael bringing up some other good points about this. So again, go revisit that, or I will surely re-listen to that and document those things as well, and release that as soon as I can. PowerShell. Also, I'm presuming a fair amount of you do not use PowerShell, but nonetheless, always make sure that you're keeping PowerShell up to date as well. So, for instance, I know that you can install PowerShell 7.x versions, 7.lts, alongside if PowerShell, like a 5.x version, is still there. They can actually be installed parallel. So, and just like with any other application, the problem here that is being exposed are possible vulnerabilities, right? So, the older the versions are, the more vulnerabilities they can have, right? I guess that's not exactly the right way to put that, but generally, older versions have vulnerabilities that may not be getting patched anymore, may be out of support, and things like that. So, obviously, the newer versions are going to, people developing these are continually trying to make them more secure and safer. So, make sure that you don't have any older versions on there. Then, something I talked about last week is password managers. Having password managers to manage all your passwords encrypted, so that you don't have use the same password for every account that you have, right? Okay, I think that pretty much covers the Windows stuff. Give me just a moment here. Okay. Yeah, so let's talk about Linux. Some a handful of the things that I mentioned on the Windows side are also still prevalent on are st and are still, they still be applied on the Linux side as well, like around the hardware conversation that I had in the beginning of that, and then Michael and I had earlier today. Your TPM can still be an option, right? It's all the same hardware. You can You could use full disk encryption. I have full disk encryption running on my Linux System 76 Pop! OS machine. Right, so those things still apply. Ensuring you keep your software cleaned up and not having a bunch of nonsense installed that you're not using. Running appropriate updates. If you're using RDP, if you're remoting into things or not, versus RDP for Linux, you'll want to make sure that you don't have SCP enabled or you don't have SSH enabled, and I'll talk about those in just a minute. Logging into web browsers because you're still using web browsers, don't do that. Creating additional accounts on Linux, which in my opinion is even easier to do. You disable root, you create your elevated privilege account, and then you create additional accounts where they don't have any access, and you just provide them access to the things they need. And an easy way to do that using the chmod command. You can provide rewrite, execute access to every single individual folder, file, etc. that you want to. So all of those things generally apply to all operating systems. Even Apple. I'm not going to get an Apple right now, but just as a side note, we discussed this earlier. My opinion is the whole thing is just for a little side tangent here. There's a misconception that one operating system may be more secure than others. Some people think Linux is the most secure. Some people think Apple is the most secure. Some people think Windows is the least secure. This is a misconception and not exactly accurate. So the accuracy here is around usage and opportunity for the bad actors, right? So, 15 years ago or so, Apple wasn't used that much, and Linux wasn't either, or not in mainstream household usage, right? It was Windows. So the opportunity and the return of investment, or possible return of investment and opportunity there, what was there for bad actors when it came to Windows? If you got a million people using something versus five people using something, you have a 999,995 more opportunities to compromise somebody, right? So, I mean, this day and age, Linux is extremely common, Apple's extremely common, and so is Windows, right? So, if you go and do a little research, you'll learn that there are a lot of vulnerabilities out there for all of these OSs, right? It's an extremely common thing for all of them alike. I'm continuously seeing vulnerabilities being patched for Apple, for example. Go look up something called CVE, right? Go look at all the current CVEs out there for Apple, Windows, etc., right? So anyway, wherever I was going with that, I guess just to sum that up, every operating system is vulnerable. Every application is vulnerable. It just depends on if the bad actors are going to take advantage of that or not. So Linux. So let me, I'll talk through all of these things, but I'll just kind of walk through a basic checklist that you can use to start off with. Disabling SSH, right? If you don't plan on remoting into that, this is remoting into other systems, right? Then you'll want to disable SSH. Now, if you do, that is totally fine. You simply disable root access for SSH so that the root account can no longer, you can no longer SSH into the system with root. Also, changing the default SSH port. The default port is 22, right? So the default name is root. The default port is 22. So knowing that, Every bad actor in the world knows that as well, right? So what are they, the very first thing they're going to try? They're going to try Root and they're going to try Port 22. So if you left one of those open, then they can, then that's one less hurdle for them to get past to in order to access your system and compromise things, right? So pick a random port and create another user account and don't allow root ac or SSH root access. Also, don't leave it. First of all, don't also, one thing I didn't put in this list, and I'll say it before I forget, is not to have empty passwords, just like I said earlier for Windows. Don't have empty passwords in user accounts that you create. If there's no password and it's empty, that's another hurdle that the bad actor doesn't have to overcome. Now, along with SSH, another thing I would do is turn off SSH password login authentication, right? So if your SS if your user account is Bob and your password is Alice, well, if you disable password authentication for SSH, then when you try to SSH into your system, then using the password will not be an option, right? Why you don't want that to be an option because a bad actor can brute force that. So instead, what you use are is are private and public keys. The method, two methods that are commonly used, and in my opinion, are good to use is RSA, and don't use that with, I would say, anything less than 4096. I think Michael mentioned earlier that he used to use like 16.328 something. Anything less than 4096 is pretty much unsecure, or not that safe. So again, RSA 4096, or you can, I think a lot of people are starting to use ED 25519, which can be argued to be even more secure. So again, look at those two options for creating your private and public keys. So what you'll do is you'll keep your private key on your system. The public key will then be put into your authentication keys file in your SSH folder on your other system. So when you go to that, when you're on that system and you're remoting into your system, the public key that you're remoting from will be able to be shared with the system you're trying to remote in. The system you're remoting into will use that public key to authenticate to that private key, and then you'll be able to log in. Right, so that's a pretty secure way to remote into another Linux system. Also use OpenSSH and SCP. So I mentioned SCP earlier, that is used for file transferring. Again, so when you use SCP, if you have SSH set up correctly, like how I just described, then SCP you also need to authenticate the same way in order for to download or upload files. Yeah, and I would not suggest using FTP or Telnet or things of that like. Yeah, I mentioned full disk encryption. Let's see here. IP tables. Yeah, okay, so two other things that you could use are, that I would suggest using is UFW and fail to ban. So UFW is a built-in firewall on Linux. It's extremely easy to use. A good practice to follow, a difficult but good practice to follow, is whitelisting versus blacklisting. So the difference is blacklisting is everything being allowed through and you only blocking things as you need to. Whitelisting is blocking everything and then whitelisting the things you need to make work. On now, if you're using a system for like a snake pool and you have a relay server, the whitelisting ability there is the best way to go because you're not really running anything else on that system. You might be running a remote monitoring tool or something like that, but you can just allow the port and IP for that in UFW. Now, if you're using this at home for your personal usage and you're doing all sorts of other things, that might be more challenging. It's still something to look at if you're willing to do it, but if not, then either way, just make sure you're using UFW, their firewall. The other thing is fail to ban the number two. It's basically an IPS, intrusion prevention system, tool, and it does all sorts of things. One common example would be if someone is trying to DDoS your system, distributed denial of service, right? So a denial of service is one thing hitting a server, or for simple terms, a website or something, as many times as possible to try to overload it, try to slow it down, try to, break it, right? Now, a more advanced technique is distributed denial of service. So an example would be if I had 500 different systems out there all trying to hit this server at the exact same time. Now that obviously gives you much more of a chance of taking down that application or that website, that server. There are ways to protect against that. Fail to ban will help with that. Rate limiting features. You can increase the rate limiting. So what will happen is, just if your system's getting too hit too fast, too frequently, it'll block that stuff. What else? And I had another good idea, I lost it. But anyway, if you're using something like Cloudflare has a feature in there. You enable it for DDoS, and it'll provide you DDoS protection as well. Yeah, one second. Yeah, okay, so staying along with that idea, some things you can do to routinely check your system instead of relying on tools and software to do it for you to ensure it's safe and protected and secure, would be, let's continue with the DDoS situation. So outside of bad actors, as a good actor, you with your own website, you can try to do some penetration testing on your site. One common thing would be to test against DDoS, right? So there are tools out there you can use, such tools, for example, HPing3, as well as Saphira, Saphyra. You can use these tools out there to try to DDoS your system. I'd be very cautious in using these tools because they can and are used also in malicious activity. So don't do this to other people's systems. You can definitely be held li legally liable for that. If you want to test your own system, those are some good options to do. Use Along with that is something else. If you're even more advanced, you can do something. You could go to byob.dev. You can build your own. You can set up your own botnet, and then the botnet will be your mechanism to execute that DDoS. Different DDoS techniques are HTTP floods, UDP floods, ICMP floods, things like that. And using these tools, they can get a little more advanced too. So that's why you need to have different things out there to protect against DDoS and attacks of that nature. Basically, the payload of each ping, they can have different information in each payload, and in turn they're getting a little more sophisticated and bypassing some general or some common security solutions and security mechanisms out there, right? So again, some things I've talked about before, layered security. Yeah, and furthermore, around monitoring your system, don't forget that there are tools out there, NetStat, right? NetStat can be used on any operating system, but you can run NetStat-Tulpin, Tulpn. This will show all of your active listening ports and associated IPs. That way, you'll know if you need to create any new firewalls or something is in your system that shouldn't be. You can use Nmap, network scanning tool. You can start off with Nmap, dash S, lowercase S, uppercase T. Or you can use SS-Tulpin. All of this will show that information about what is happening network wise, right? Listening ports, IPs, your active connections to your system. SE Linux is another good thing to use. It is great for things such as RBAC or role-based access control, user control, also rule-based access to for ports and processes, files and directories, things like that. So go ahead, I would suggest checking out SE Linux. Let's see here. Yeah, checking your installed packages on Linux using D package or dpkg dash dash list. You can see your installed packages. And then you can remove things you're not using because a lot of times things like Snap might be installed by default. And if you're not using Snap, then why keep it? What else? I think I saw one. Oh, yeah. And then obviously System CTL. System CTL is mon is. A way to, you can see which services are active and running on your system. And in terms of those services, another thing to monitor would be your general CTL. So general CTL is on Linux is what is used to log all of the information for those running services. Along that lines, there's also a tool out there called LogWatch. LogWatch is great for log monitoring. So go ahead and give that a check out as well. Yeah. I think that is it for now. Oh yeah, I mentioned one other thing about IDS, Probably shouldn't even mention this because I should spend more time amplifying on this. But for Linux, there's a tool out there people like to use called Snort. And speaking of Snort, something Lath brought up earlier and that I've brought up in previous spaces around monitoring your system, trying out penetration techniques, testing out DDoS, trying out all sorts of things to ensure your site application, etc., secure is using Kali Linux. If you're not familiar with all these tools I've talked about, Kali Linux is a great thing to start with to start learning. There's all sorts of tutorials out there on how to use it. You can go to Linode, Linode. It's yet just another cloud service provider out there. You can go there and spin up a VM and have a server running. But they have a there's a guy, Network Chuck, that I watch on YouTube a lot, and he uses Linode, and I learned from him that there is a Kali Linux image on there. You can go spin it up. So you don't have to worry about knowing how to install it and all that stuff and get it running. You just spin that up and you get into it and you start playing around with the different tools. It has an absolute list or slew of different tools in there that are all used for different penetration testing things. A lot of the things we've already covered, you can monitor tests, etc., with Kali Linux. So I would really suggest checking that out. I think that covers it about for now. If you are listening to this recording and you've actually made it to this very end of it, good job. And thank you for listening in. And we'll talk. And I'll be doing this again for anybody that wants to join and ask any other questions tomorrow at 7 a.m. Otherwise, take care and I hope you have a great week.